Show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Minute past the hour, and hey, welcome to Friday on the Front Porch on the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where the Listen Live button is. That's where the PayPal button is. That's where the contact, the address for helping keep us going by contributing via traditional mail is. Over at WhiteRoseSociety.org, there are other streaming links under the subdomain for this program. And the podcast feed is there as well. Diggity. Like I said, it's Friday on the Front Porch, and this particular Friday, things are looking up a little bit, we hope. We came very, very close to meeting our fundraising goal last night. And thus, we find ourselves this evening looking to raise $195. That'll take us into the weekend with some measure of equanimity, this being the halfway mark, holy cow, can you believe it, of the month of August. Friday on the Front Porch being a time when we can just look at some other things that might otherwise have missed the cut during the course of a given broadcast week. And that hopefully involves you, involved in discussion here. Here's a lovely one for you. Let's just get started with this. Chris, also known as Blue Ape in the chat room, headonradionetwork.com/chatroom. And it's really a what the moment. Just when you think that you can halfway admire somebody, they come out and they say something so unutterably stupid that you have to rethink everything. Hello, Julian Assange, who, it is being reported, says he is a profound admirer of Rand and Ron Paul. Dear God, somebody's put something in the Kool-Aid over at the Ecuadorian embassy in London. First it was Code Pink, and now him. This would be the same Rand Paul who said, you know, I don't really think anybody's being discriminated against when we try to keep people from voting in elections. Yeah, that... And we certainly aren't discriminating against any of those colored people. Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist. Julian Assange also noting that Matt Drudge is a great media innovator. I know a lot of people admire Julian Assange. I have too up until today. But I have some standards. And you can't be a buddy of Rand Paul and think that you're any kind of progressive or a liberal or actually give a rat's rear end about humanity or freedom or democracy. No. No. Just no. So there's that. There's a whole bunch of other that's, though. I mean, but this just kind of, I don't know, it rattled me a little bit when I read it. From over at Huffington Post, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange gave a strong endorsement to the libertarian wing of the GOP on Thursday, praising Senator Rand Paul and his father, Cranky Ron Paul, for their political views. I'm a big admirer of Ron Paul and Rand Paul for their very principled positions in the U.S. Congress on a number of issues. They have been the strongest supporters of the fight against the U.S. attack on WikiLeaks and on me in the U.S. Congress. Similarly, they have been the strongest opponents of drone warfare and extrajudicial executions. Well, that's simply not true. But now that Julian Assange has a bromance going on, as many other progressives got hoodooed into doing, with Rand Paul, I'm pretty much done with Julian Assange. I don't know about you, but I am. You wanna go and play footsie with an ignorant little proto-fascist? Go right ahead. But I think it's sort of... I'll be honest. I was surprised by this. Maybe there are those who weren't, but I was. I mean, Jesus H. Christ, he said, Assange did, that the libertarian wing, the libertarian strain of the Republican Party is, quote, the only hope for American electoral politics. Well, when you say that and you acknowledge, when you say that, you kind of have to acknowledge that, of course, the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, along with the rest of the Republican Party, is just fine with all of these voter suppression dodges going down in the several states, whether it be Texas or Florida or North Carolina or anywhere else that Alec-inspired, Alec-enhanced, Alec-financed Republicans are working. So where does that leave us? The only hope for electoral freedom in the United States, according to Julian Assange, comes from people who don't like for people to run around doing stuff like voting. If you can triangulate some sort of way of viewing that that doesn't involve the sort of realizing that Julian Assange has just jumped the Sharknado, drop me a note. Because that beats cat's effing as far as I'm concerned. And you got to wonder what kind of love will be coming back his way from Rand and Ron. Ophthalmologists deserve to have a comfortable living, comfortably well off. Just wow. Wow. Note came in overnight from Robert in Australia. He said, listening to Thursday's program on podcast, I was at physio most of the morning. You said at one point that 1 month's health insurance for your family would cost about $2,000, if I heard that correctly. And you did, Robert. Happy weekend to you. Happy good Saturday morning. So Americans can pay around $24,000 per year for health insurance for a family of five. Is that correct? That's the way it was last I looked. I immediately went online to check the cost of 1 month of health insurance for a family of five, two parents, and three children here in Australia. Now, these figures are very rough, but they'll give you an idea of the approximate costs. Assuming basic medical and hospital coverage, for a family of five, you're looking at between $220 and $300 per month. And as with most insurance, there are things not covered. You need specific extra insurance for some conditions and rehabilitation and so forth. Okay. So you're looking at between $2,400 and $3,600 per year for a family of five. I wonder how many Americans know that not only do we have universal single-payer health care in Australia, but that the cost of private insurance is a fraction of that of the U.S. That number would almost certainly, Robert, be mathematically impossible to calculate, because so many Americans don't even know what comes on after "Here Comes Honey Boo Boo Child." I wish I was joking. Robert continues, "When these costs started to rise some years back, many Australians dropped their private insurance, which led to John Howard's government introducing a 30% tax rebate on the cost of private health insurance, corporate welfare effectively, to encourage people to retain or take out private health insurance to avoid putting a strain on the public system. And just to make sure people were suitably encouraged, they increased the Medicare levy on anyone who didn't, which led to a situation where many people took out private health insurance to avoid paying higher Medicare levy, but not using the private insurance when they got ill and just using Medicare. So a big win for the insurance companies. They get paid for doing precisely nothing." Which oddly enough is their goal here in the United States too. Will you please continue paying your premiums until you die? Don't go to the doctor. Isn't that telling? $220 to $300 a month for health care coverage in the United States. Now, to be fair, maybe it'll work out that way when the exchanges come online and the government subsidies for the for-profit health insurance industry kick in. But there's still a problem insofar as we're taking taxpayer dollars and subsidizing the for-profit health insurance industry. Because, yes, that would be corporate welfare. And frankly, they've got enough money, don't they? Well, hey, maybe somebody can ask Julian Assange and he can say that for-profit health insurance companies are the last best hope of America to have meaningful health care. I'm sorry, that was a little snarky. But that pisses me off. Really? Really, Mr. Assange? Really? Do you even know who Rand Paul is? Do you not? Of course you don't. Of course you don't. A retraction is in order. But don't expect one. Note coming in from Ron and Raleigh. Hey, Bob. Hey, Ron. First day off, and I'm trying to catch up. I don't know whether you've addressed the Mitch Daniels Howard Zinn controversy. I really haven't. It's been covered in other places, but you know, gee whiz, Mitch Daniels tried to suppress the historic scholarship of Howard Zinn. Yeah, really. Mike Malloy has always said that Republicans are liars and cowards. It's true he has, and it's true they are. The postmortem attacks on Howard Zinn by the half-pint former governor of Indiana proves that point. Mitch Daniels waited until Howard Zinn was dead to start going after the people's history of the United States, demanding that it not be used for any purposes in Indiana schools. Right? Yeah. The version of history taught in schools today is even less inclusive than the version taught to me in the 50s and 60s. Yesterday, Jesse Jackson and his wife were sentenced to prison for misuse of campaign funds in the case of Mr. Jackson and the failure to report the income to the IRS by Mrs. Jackson. Mrs. Jackson failed to report $600,000 to the IRS and was sentenced to a year in prison. Isn't this the exact thing that Slappy Thomas in Virginia were found to have done, yet they were able to submit an amended tax return, no fine, no jail time? Yeah, it's precisely that thing. The only difference being, I guess, that in Jesse Jackson Jr.'s case, there were campaign funds as such involved. And then this. Lastly, says Ron and Raleigh, he whose name shall not be mentioned said on his program today that he is now writing a column at the Daily Caller. All in the name of reasonable discourse and comity. No, C-O-M-I-T-Y, not C-O-M-E-D-Y. Because that's kind of laughable. Reasonable discourse and comedy at a place like the Daily Caller. That's Tucker Carlson's little the storefront and Bowtie Emporium. Ron says, I swear that man drives me to distraction. Oy. P.S. If Edward Snowden is such a threat to U.S. national security, why don't we send a drone after him? After all, he's committed a greater crime than Anwar al-Awlaki. Oh, that's right. He's in a country with white people, and President Not Sure only blows brown people into red mist. True. Across the board. True. And speaking of Russia, a controversy is beginning to brew. It's probably past the beginning stages, if the truth be told. A controversy is in place over this call to boycott the Olympics in Sochi, Russia, because Ed Snowden's host has decided to crack down upon people for being the way they are, the way they were born, i.e., you know, no gay propaganda, no gay adoptions, no... Right. Harvey Firestein. Firestein? I always forget. Playwright. Lambasted Chris Hayes of MSNBC for his... dismissal of the idea that it might be a good idea, dismissal of the notion that it would be a good idea to boycott the Russian Sochi Winter Olympics. Hayes just sort of blithely, you know, it's not a good idea because it would hurt the athletes. And the International Olympic Committee is beginning to have a hissy because they're afraid that people will pull a Dr. John Carlos in Sochi and maybe wear a little rainbow flag pin or dedicate their performance. Me? I'm not so quick to dismiss the idea. I think if people are inclined to protest, they should act within the confines of their consciences, and not be lectured by some media star of any variety. Of course, then again, I take a completely different view of what the purpose is of a program like this, or, you know, because I'm not selling denture cream or wave radios or encouraging to buy gold. We're trying to foster a dialogue, a conversation here. And so, necessarily, we're not going to be prone to telling people what to do or how to do it. And all I can do is be aware of privilege as opposed to asserting it. So, you know, Harvey Firestein's Facebook post to Chris Matthews started out something like, Dear Straight White Guy. But I've become more and more sensitive of late to the idea of being lectured at by anyone. I think it first gelled for me when I began seeing posts that were titled What You Need to Know About or Everything You Need to Know About. Because that's awfully damned presumptuous, isn't it? It seems so to me. So all I can say is act on your conscience. That's the only marching orders I'm going to give. Act according to the best dictates of your conscience. And anybody who says, oh no, don't do that because of the purity of the Olympics, please. The Olympics are as pure as the driven slush. So, yeah, that. Notes coming in from Jack in Shreveport. Jack says, with regard to Assange, I was surprised by this new information about Assange supporting right-wing politics. This just doesn't make sense to me. I think we ought to give this some time to see if something we don't know comes to light. And, Jack, I just don't know what that something we don't know would possibly be. But we do know that Rand Paul has somehow managed to sucker progressives before. I mean, you remember when he stood bold and alone in the Senate to allegedly filibuster drones until it turned out that he wasn't filibustering drones. He was okay with drones being used to slaughter brown people or blow them, as Malloy says, into a red mist. It was just if the EPA was going to use drones to fly over and observe giant contained animal feed operations, CAFOs, feedlot operations, where cattle stand up to their own, do cattle have knees? Up to their own knees in their own excrement. And when they fall down and dying and sick are picked up with a front end loader and taken over to the wood chipper meat processing thingamajig to be turned into your Dinty Moore beef stew. Well, even if they got mad cow, if we cook it real good in the can, it'll kill off all them little prions. And in the process of that, people like Code Pink got all squishy. And Medea Benjamin came out and talked about how large Rand Paul's testicles are. So I don't know that we can know, Jack, that anything new, expect anything new to come out. But what we can know is that for some reason or another, people who otherwise consider themselves to be progressives, for God's sakes, I'm still not over it. Code Pink delivered flowers and chocolates, probably while singing, to Rand Paul's office. That is just sick-making. We are very easily conned on our side. Darlene offering a counterpoint to Jack. Regarding Julian Assange, I was through with this guy when the allegations came out that he raped two women in Sweden. I felt that the women's stories were compelling. I'm disappointed, Bob, that you still admired him up to this point. I would think that the allegations he raped two women would be enough to call him into question, at least. I'm not surprised that he likes Ron and Rand Paul. The only reason I was concerned about him being returned to Sweden was the real possibility that he would be brought to the United States and tortured. And I don't mean anything extraordinary. I mean sent into the American penal system, which any American prison is torture. We tend to act, I cannot support torture. That is not to say that I thought that... Sweden's laws are what Sweden's laws are. And it is not at all clear, or has not been made at all clear to me, what the charges are there. I've read that it had something to do about him not using a condom. And I've read others say, no, it was rape. Really, really, really rape. And I get real edgy when I hear rape defined as anything but rape. So, it would be good if there could be some clarity in the matter. But if whatever regard I had for him is now gone. And frankly, I'll say this much in regard to what Darlene notes. If you are willing to wallow with Rand and Ron Paul, in my eyes, that makes it far more likely that you take the rights of women very non-seriously. Quite possibly up to and including the right not to be raped. Because there's a mindset that goes with the folks who go wallowing with Rand and Ron. Then, of course, in regard to issue of the Sochi Olympics, there's this. Coming from Marty. Isn't Chris Hayes on MSNBC part of NBC, which holds the TV rights to the 2014 Winter Games and no doubt has sunk a great deal of Comcast's money into it? Yes, that MSNBC. That's a tough question, Isaac. How many times have, coming via Twitter, Bob, how many times have Obama, Reid, and Pelosi suckered the progressives? Liberals, whatever we want to call ourselves. I don't know. I don't think I've ever been suckered by them. Because when Barack Obama was running for president, I was pretty clear on the fact that he was not a progressive. That he was at best a center-right moderate. But you can't, it's not the same thing. It is not the same thing. Because, for instance, if you want to describe Obama, Reid, and Pelosi as suckering the progressives, there's no question but Nancy Pelosi supports a woman's right to choose. Rand Paul does not. Even Harry Reid, as malleable as he can be, has been rather unequivocal on significant issues related that matter to us. We would, our beef with Harry Reid is that we would like for him to be more spineful. And then Barack Obama, like I said, who thought he was progressive? Who still thinks he's progressive? Because I got a Brooklyn Bridge in the middle of the Gobi Desert to sell you if you do. Marty noting, true, the only candidate who was close to being a progressive in 2008 was John Edwards, and we know what happened to him. Well, I don't know if it was what happened to him or what he did to himself. Going on in the chat room, headonradionetwork.com/chatroom, regarding Assange. Lottie saying, I don't think Assange supports right-wing politics. I think he supports Ron and Rand Paul and their support of privacy and the right to protect whistleblowers. I understand that, Lottie, but by the same token, if you say that right-wing politics, which is what he said, he didn't say Ron and Rand Paul, he said, you know, right-wing politics are the only hope that the American electoral system has. And that is, no, that's enough to bring about the divorce for me. Marty taking a little umbrage at something I said earlier. Having both hidden and blocked TLC, I don't know what's on after Honey Boo Boo. And neither do I. But I think you understand the general tenor of my criticism. Marty, you say that like Edwards was the only person getting it outside of marriage, which of course we know is bunk. That's not what I said at all. I said that he did what he did to himself. Just like anybody who gets caught in something like that has done it to themselves, whether it's my business or anybody else's, except the people to the party to the transaction. That's another matter entirely. And then this coming in from our buddy, the Angry Indian. Why is anyone surprised by what Assange said? He's a libertarian. Most of these fellow travelers are. They only sound like they support real freedom. Objectively speaking, the more you know about the case in Sweden, the rules of the EU, and about the political lobbying group behind the charges and how the charges came about in the first place, it seems plausible. It's a... and I'm not going to use that euphemism, Angry. I hope you're not offended. It seems plausible that it is a setup. Thanks. So you get a little bit of a sense of the stuff that's out there for today. By the way, Arizona. Prescott, Arizona. And the Prescott Valley. Man, stories like this just... According to the Prescott Valley Police Department... Oh, dear. At about 4:30 p.m., there was officers responded to a call to a residence on Gentle Winds Road. Oh, dear. ''56-year-old Gary Wingate was found dead. 54-year-old Mrs. Wingate was found with her husband's dead body. I'm not sure here how long the couple had been married. But apparently, Mrs. Wingate had repeatedly made Mr. Wingate aware of the fact that she was not at all comfortable handling his firearms, and that is not a euphemism. And the weekend was coming up, this weekend that's upon us now, and Mr. Wingate wanted to go out and teach Mrs. Wingate to shoot the shooting gun. Because, you know, Wolverines, right? Freedom! And even though she had told him, I'm not okay with this, he said, honey, hand me the shotgun. Give me the 12-gauge there, baby. And even though she had repeatedly said, I don't want to even touch it. Oh, baby, you got to get comfortable with this because, you know, our Second Amendment rights is what Jesus died for on the cross. Or some similar sort of drivel, most likely. Just give me the shotgun. And having done so, and having said, just give me the shotgun, Mrs. Wingate picked up the shotgun and managed to accidentally blow Mr. Wingate away. From lawful gun owner to awful gun owner, in whatever space of time it takes to negligently squeeze the trigger on a 12-gauge. She was, of course, extremely distraught when the police arrived. Prescott Valley Police Department Sergeant Brandon Bonney said, "It seems that they meant to take the shotgun out this weekend on a trip, and he wanted her to get more familiar with it." It's twice in just a few months. Three, as a matter of fact. Twice in just in just 3 months that the Prescott Valley Police Department have had to respond to the accidental shooting of one family member by another family member. Because of, you know, all that freedom protecting gun owning. Back in June, it was a matter of a 4-year-old boy who blew his daddy away. And Sergeant Bonney also noted that on two other occasions, people have shot themselves while cleaning their firearms. Sergeant Bonney said, "It's important to remember that you should never point a weapon at something if you're not willing to destroy it and treat every weapon as if it was loaded." And yeah, and the angry Indian's right. This is going to, this isn't going to get better. This is, in fact, going to get worse and worse and worse. Because more people are going to be whipped into a frenzy over firearms ownership. Look at the record number of guns and ammunition sold since Barack Obama became president of the United States. How many of those people? Listen, if you are dippy enough to believe that the Kenyan Muslim socialist anti-colonialist with a deep-seated hatred of white people is coming after your guns, you're probably not intelligent enough to own one, let alone operate it. Worth considering at the very least, I think. Dear Jesus. This case, like the case last night, coming out of Houston, comes out of Texas. Remember the story last night, the Houston deputy? Who responded to a call from a woman about harassing phone calls, took her upstairs in her home and raped her, who has now resigned and remains unnamed. Well, here's another Texas deputy. Also out of Harris County. And this has to do with a woman named Camina Figueroa, who called 911 to say that Kamal Yazar was acting crazy after several days of using bath salts. She had gotten her children out of reach of Mr. Yazar, who was, by the way, her son-in-law. So, Deputy Harris County Deputy Brady Pullen arrived on the scene, at which point Kamal Yazar apparently jumped him. The deputy claims that he was bitten and his nose was broken. And Pullen and his other deputies tasered Yazar. And once they had tasered him, they pumped multiple rounds of pistol ammunition through his body, ending his life. That's what Pullen says. Corinna Padilla is a brother-in-law. Kamal Yazar was brother-in-law to Corinna Padilla. She tells a different story, having witnessed it firsthand. She said, "At no moment did Kamal assault the officer. An unarmed man, a family guy, father, and husband of three girls, was killed. He had no criminal record. He was self-employed in import-export of very expensive rugs from Turkey and Persia." She said that it wasn't bath salts, but that Yazar was suffering from stress and had drunk some tea that caused him to hallucinate. So, even with all of that, that's not the last word in this. Harris County Deputy Brady Pullen has filed a lawsuit against Carmina Figueroa for $200,000 for failure to adequately warn 911 dispatchers that, in the words of the lawsuit papers, Yazar posed a violent threat to others. There's some portion of me that thinks that this is probably some sort of systemic abuse. In other words, abuse of the legal process. You file the lawsuit against her to shut up the rest of them who are saying that no, he and his cohorts just went in and basically executed Mr. Yazar. The suit is being described as unprecedented. We are a gun-crazy culture. Jan writing in from the UK. Hi, Jan. Julian Assange is just creepy. It is, in fact, going to be a busy little thorn in the side, or a Friday on the front porch. A lot of resonance over last night's story of what Irish Dave referred to as the WOT, W-O-T. Remember, that used to stand for War on Terror. Now, at least in Texas, it stands for War on Tomatoes. Everyone who is familiar with tomato planting writing in, and I mean there were a bunch of you, seemed to uniformly agree that with Kenny's call last night, that the difference between a cannabis plant and a tomato plant is not only obvious, but profound. Marijuana berries. That's what them tomatoes were. And then this. I never cease to be amazed. Thank you. Thank you to everybody who finds this stuff and sends it along, and to the organizations that go looking for it. Who knew that there was a program out there called Creation Today? Oh, I do now. Not necessarily happy about it, but I do now. Creation Today having to do with creationism, which is not science, but then again, you know that. Creationism being what you also, the, you know, 7 days, young earth, Satan placed the fossils in the rocks to confuse the unbelievers. Oh, it becomes so tiresome. But every now and then, somebody comes out from behind the cockroachy little baseboards of the creation movement and still manages to shock. Derek, D-A-R-E-K, Darek, Jesus, sounds like somebody from Norblap 9 on Star Trek Next Generation. Darek Isaacs has written a book called Dragons or Dinosaurs. Let us cut to the tape. It's not really tape, of course.
And we want to welcome Derek Isaacs to the program. Derek, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You are the author of the book, Dragons or Dinosaurs, Creation or Evolution. Paul, would you model that for us? Wow, very good job modeling.
Yeah, you're no Carol Merrill,
Paul. We love this book because it really covers the subject so well. Can you give us a little history about yourself and tell us why you wrote the book?
Well, why I wrote it is very simple, is that the Bible speaks about dragons. And
what?
All the authority, everything.
Speaks about giants, too. Speaks about virgins having babies. Well, not really. Speaks about people getting up from being dead. Speaks about little nieces getting their... Uncle? Daddy. Can't remember which. Daddy, I think. Yeah, Lot's. Wasn't it Lot's daughters? Got her daddy all liquored up? And rode his old bones? Yeah, it speaks about a lot of things, but how about that? I must have missed the dragons part. Oh, well.
A little history about yourself and tell us why you wrote the book.
Well, why I wrote it is very simple, is that the Bible speaks about dragons. And our authority, everything that we do, we have to measure by the Word of God. That's what I believe. And so we have to go to the...
Measure by the Word of God. The Empire State Building is 150,000 words of God tall. But which Bible? I mean, you know, it'd be considerably taller, I guess, if we were using the little pocket versions of the New Testament Psalms and Proverbs that are passed out by the Gideons, the Giddy-ups. Measure by the... Oh, dear.
Bible, and the Bible speaks about dragons. It speaks about dragons in the Old Covenant Scriptures. But you know something? It speaks about dragons in the New Testament. If you look at the book of Revelation, Satan...
Oh. It speaks about dragons in the New Testament. And I thought this was going to be Old Testament stuff. But no. Do you ever wonder if somebody's going to discover the writings of, oh, I don't know, C.S. Lewis in a couple of thousand years and think that back in the 20th century human beings rode the backs of lions? Now, it's true, Mark Antony, when he was master of the horse, which was second in command under Julius Caesar's dictatorship, did go a little over the top and have a chariot pulled by lions take him through the Roman Forum, but it was not routine. He was trying to emulate Heracles. Dragons are mentioned in the New Testament because John, sitting there on Patmos, was hallucinating his brains out.
Is compared to a dragon over and over again. Like 13 times in the book of Revelations, dragon is used, and it's either referring to Satan or some kind of evil. Now, what's fascinating is throughout history...
What's fascinating is that none of that exists in history, Darek.
On every continent, in all these historical works, we see dragons are portrayed as lethal predators.
That no one had ever actually seen. Dragon bones were ground up for medicine among the ancient Chinese, or what were called dragon bones. Wait. Is there not also a passage in Cervantes? Don Quixote. Is there not also a passage where Don Quixote has to take on a dragon? But is that dragon not imaginary? One wonders if Darek has read Don Quixote, maybe of dragons and dinosaurs and dragons or... See, that's the title of the book, Dragons or Dinosaurs, not Dragons and Dinosaurs. For Darek Isaacs, there can be dragons. You know, here be dragons. Or there can be dinosaurs. But it is apparently, they are apparently mutually exclusive. There were either dragons or there were dinosaurs. I have a feeling, tennis ball, duct tape, strap into the arms of the chair.
There's these big, giant, scaled reptiles that are just lethal, and they will kill you. They kill livestock. They are really the apex of apex predators. And here we have, in Revelations, God explaining to us,
Or John hallucinating his brains out, but there I go again.
Using a dragon as the imagery of saying, you know, Satan is like a dragon. And so he is comparing the predator to us, Satan.
He's comparing one imaginary beast to another imaginary beast. Howdy do!
As a dragon. And he uses that imagery because the people, you know, 2,000 years ago would have understood the lethality that came with dragons.
Did you just hear what I just heard? I think I'm going to put the straw in the tequila bottle early. People 2,000 years ago would have understood the lethality of a dragon. Well, people in the present understood that this guy should probably be kept in a rubber room and allowed to write on the walls with a purple crayon tucked between his toes. Oh, for pity's sakes. It reminds me of something. I bet you know what it already know what it reminds me of. 2,000 years ago, people would have understood the lethality of dragons. Sure they would have. If they were really there. Yeah, the angry Indian asking, what would Freud say? We're leaving the doc over with his cigar in the corner for now. Angry with a note. Chupacabra calling. The jabbers. Sometimes it is just entirely too much. what I was thinking of and what the production computer does not want me to, apparently not want me to do, is to play that delightful. Oh, wait a minute. I got a way around this. Because when the Spirit moves one to reference the prophets, one fails to reference the prophets at one's hazard. I'm wondering if this will work. Let's find out. Sorry for the dead air, but you know, these things happen. Oh, come on. I was so proud of myself. What I'm doing right now is I'm restarting the production computer because it's not cooperating. And apparently, well, let me see if we're even still streaming. No, we're still sending. How about that? Well, anyway, it's 3 minutes before the hour and probably ought to get somewhere near the end of the filibobster, so let's, if the computer will allow me, let's restart this thing. And take a little break. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll be back.
Bush being gone, man, because for the last 12 years with Reagan and Bush, we have had fundamentalist Christians in the White House. Fundamentalist Christians who believe the Bible is the exact word of God, including that
it worked. Dragons.
Fire and brimstone Revelations ending, have had their finger on the fucking button for 12 years. Tell me when, Lord. Tell me when. Let me be your servant, Lord. Fundamentalist Christianity, fascinating. These people actually believe the world is 12,000 years old. I swear to God. Based on what? I asked them. Well, we looked at all the people in the Bible and we added them up all the way back to Adam and Eve. Their ages, 12,000 years. Well, how fucking scientific. Okay. I didn't know that you'd gone to so much trouble there. That's good. You believe the world's 12,000 years old. Is that true? Okay, I got one word to ask you. One word question. Ready?
Uh-huh.
Dinosaur. You know, the world's 12,000 years old and dinosaurs existed, and they existed in that time. You think it would have been mentioned in the fucking Bible at some point. And oh, Jesus and the disciples walked to Nazareth, but the trail was blocked by a giant brontosaurus with a splinter in his paw. And oh, the disciples did run a shrieking, what a big fucking lizard, Lord. But Jesus was unafraid, and he took the splinter from the brontosaurus' paw, and the big lizard became his friend. And Jesus sent him to Scotland, where he lived in a loch for oh so many years,
inviting thousands of American tourists to bring their fat fucking families and their fat dollar bills. And oh, Scotland did praise the Lord. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. Took a little bit of a turnaround to make that work, but yeah. People 2,000 years ago would have understood the lethality of dragons. And that, of course, is why the disciples, as the prophet Bill Hicks, peace be upon him, noted that, yea, verily, the disciples did run a-screaming, hollering, what a big effing dinosaur, Lord. Mercy. Jim with a query. Dragons? He asks. How about a dragon in human form? We have plenty of those. A century ago, Jim notes, ground-up Egyptian mummies were sold as forms of medicine. And even though it was a century ago, merely the mention of that just sent a full-body shiver throughout my being. Mummy, do I have to take my mummy? Yes, Mummy wants you to take your mummy, dearest. Oh. Oh, dear. So, yeah. Two 2,000 years ago, people understood the lethality of dragons. And you know who really understands the lethality of dragons? Dwarves! Back in Middle Earth, Nori and Ori and Dori and Gimli and Thor and Oakenshield, they knew about the lethality of dragons, by God. Why not cite to that? It's every bit as accurate. It's every bit as real. What would you, if you could get the Wayback Machine running, what would you give to go back and maybe, now think about this, maybe somebody already has. Somebody in the future built a time machine and traveled back to the island of Patmos and put on a suitably scary costume and stood in front of John of Patmos' cave and played upon his insanity and John of Patmos got out his little bird feather and his ink made out of poop and started scratching along on the paper. And I saw a dragon, and the dragon had 7 heads. Ah! You ever wonder how that came to be? Yeah, that way. Time machine from somebody in the future. And whoever did that is a really, really mean person. Playing on the fears and paranoid terrors of an exiled nutcase in the first place. Shame on. But let's go back to Darek Isaacs, now that we've had the definitive word from the prophet Bill Hicks, peace be upon him. It's too much. Yeah, here he is. With a nice fresh restart on the production machine, life should be considerably simpler, one hopes. Here's Darek Isaacs. The Lethality of Dragons. Oh, he'll be around in a minute. Oh, this... I'm having all kinds of computer problems right now. The Angry Indian via a message on Skype pointing out, David Icke and his lot will take this truth to the extreme, like Alex Jones. Remember, the reptilian theory Icke and Jones still promote? They found one, I say one, tribesmen in Africa who told them of an ancient legend that Icke and company push as evidence to support the veracity of their kooky theory. Yeah. And so it goes. Is that what we say at this point? It is Friday on the front porch, and we've got a little bit of the Skype group going. And if you want to join in, shoot me your email address, your contact information. I'll send that over to Skype group moderator Duncan, and you can participate too. Hey guys.
Hey Bob.
Hey Bob.
Hey Bob.
So we have Will in Chicago. We have Sergi in Fort Worth. We have Grant, and we have Duncan, and more if you wish to join in. What's happening?
Hey Bob.
I'm trying to figure out the dragon thing here. I don't know.
I'm still kind of stuck on that too.
I am amused because how would I say if I recall my history of that time, the word dragon generally referred to what people believe to be a large snake-like animal.
Represented
Chinese natural history, but I believe dragon did not. I thought you faded a minute.
No. I was just saying, Will, that, you know, there are multiple different representations of dragons. Now, under Darek Isaacs from Norblap 9's theory, that means that there have to be different, not just different dragons, but different species of dragons. Because, a dragon represented in medieval English art doesn't look anything like a dragon represented in ancient Chinese art. Right?
Gee, well, could it possibly be that people based the dragon off of real-life lizards and snakes, enlarged them on the telling of the tale for the 55th time, and people in one part of the world, another, imagine these creatures looking somewhat different? I mean, good heavens. By his logic, you could argue that they were unicorns.
Precisely.
Here's the thing.
Let's fade Darek Isaacs back up for just a minute, okay? Let's let him, because it only gets loopier. Stand by.
Files that are just lethal, and they will kill you. They kill livestock. They are really the apex of apex predators. And here we have in Revelations God explaining to
Okay, did everybody hear that? I kind of started in medias res there. But he was, you know, he explained to us already how people 2,000 years ago would have understood the profound lethality of dragons. Let's try this again.
Now, what's fascinating is throughout history, on every continent and all these historical works, we see dragons are portrayed as lethal predators. All right, there's these big, giant, scaled reptiles that are just lethal, and they will kill you. They kill livestock. They are really the apex of apex predators. And here we have, in Revelations, God explaining to us, using a dragon as the imagery of saying, you know, Satan is like a dragon. And so he is comparing the predator to us, Satan, as a dragon. And he uses that imagery because the people, you know, 2,000 years ago would have understood the lethality that came with dragons. They understood that image. They understood how dangerous they were. And they were mortal enemies to just about everything.
So you're telling me you think the dragons that are talked about in Revelation aren't just mythical, aren't just figurative speech. It's a real animal.
Well, here's the issue on that, speaking directly to that. It's a great question. If dragons, in fact, were entirely mythological, if they were a figment of imagination, and if they never ever did exist, then God just compared our adversary to a make-believe creature that never existed.
Okay, are we all square?
Yes, and I would like to point out there are holes in this fellow's logic large enough to fly Rush Limbaugh's ego through with room left over for the death star. let's touch on another animal that the King James Bible, which speaking as someone with a perhaps a little amount of study and knowledge of the original Hebrew, also says Israel. They translate one animal as unicorn. Well, they're researching that. It turns out there is an animal which is now found in the Arabian Peninsula, somewhat rare, which from the side could be mistaken for a unicorn. It's actually a type of antelope. Similarly, snakes are generally one of the big fears of human beings. My dad was a very strong man. He could not bring himself to enter the reptile house at Lincoln Park Zoo in Chicago. So this man's logic is flawed. And even if we presume, which I do not because I am not a Christian, that there was a comparison between God and a dragon, could not the comparison be a parable? Oh, wait, who uses parables? Oh, Jesus and all the prophets, likening an adversary to something that may not exist. So again, this is unsound biologically, unsound theologically, and unsound as a comparison.
Yeah, Marty just dropped a note along.
Are resorting to. We could perhaps hold our breath and wait for them to perish.
Marty just dropped a note in. He said, you knew this was coming. Admit it. The lethality of dinosaurs because we are crunchy and good with ketchup. It's the same kind of reasoning, Marty pointing out, yeah. Though the more sophisticated dinosaurs would prefer us with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Yes. Yeah. Well, here's the problem with interpreting any religious text literally. The best mystics, the best scholars know that you have to go beyond the literal meaning of a text to get to the depths of it. Ezra, 2,500 years ago, was already doing that. There's something called Pardes in Jewish studies, which is an acronym standing for multiple levels of looking at something. So when I hear the fundamentalist of any stripe, I have to ask, what translation are you using? What knowledge do you bring to bear about the culture and the context in which it was written? Because if I said someone was hanging out at a dive in downtown Chicago, and I mentioned it to someone who was learning English as a foreign language, that person might logically think dive was a swimming pool.
That's true. That's very true.
So, I mean, if you do not understand the context, it tends to make things meaningless. So I have to ask, if this is their excuse for science, can they replicate the results? The whole point of science is you can observe something, describe it, perhaps replicate it. Now, in certain cases, you are stuck with observations, the astronomy, but you can at least measure it. This cannot be measured, and I would argue that this is why creation science is not science. It can't be measured. It just takes a huge leap of faith into the ether, and one could argue just as logically for a Christian version of creation as for an Iroquois or a Norse or Celtic version of creation, and it still would not be science.
Yeah, Turtle Island.
You can
present
the same arguments. Right, and I think we have to ask...
But, you know, everything... But Will, everything changes if we, for a moment, stop... If we, unlike the ignorant fundies, stop trying to view it as science, well, because we don't, and understand it as myth-based explanations for a perceived, not an actual, but a perceived reality, and in that space, just
right.
As Joseph Campbell showed in The Power of Myth, it becomes a much much more profound thing. Dr. John just wrote in a minute ago, and actually the Angry Indian and Dr. John are both touching on the same thing. Dr. John just wrote in and said, dragons are always presented as evil and violent? No. He said, I'll stand to be corrected, but my understanding is that in Eastern mythology, dragons tended to be represented as, one, smaller than humans, two, benevolent and wise, and three, associated with nature, not destruction. Vietnamese origin myths say that people themselves are descended from dragons. So as usual, some European Christian takes his own personal mythology and extends it to all the world and all history. And the Angry Indian says something very, very similar. He says, dragons are evil in Europe and Africa and bring wisdom in Asia and the Americas, in the folklore of those regions. And he says, reference to H.P. Lovecraft was spot on. I made some Cthulhu reference the other night. He said, these bastards live in dire fear of the dark. They see monsters everywhere. Communism or Sharia are monsters to them. They can't actually see these things, but they fear it all the same. He said, that's a very Catholic way to look at the world, coming from a recovering Catholic. So, yeah... Oh, the stupid!
I call it running from hell, not going towards heaven.
Some people can only view the world as us or them, and they need an enemy. Yes.
And you know, moreover, the reason I went to that story is because that is a more ridiculous example. I mean, it's just so over the top. There's no way to get around it. A more ridiculous example of something that obtains today in asserting. And maybe this isn't going to make sense, but I'm going to try really hard. In asserting that dragons are real, well, these are the same people who assert that global climate catastrophe isn't. It is easier for them to wrap their heads around the reality of dragons 2,000 years ago. And remember, it has to be 2,000 years ago because there's no Earth more than 7,000 years ago. They can do that with no evidence whatsoever, and yet at the same time they cannot cope with the idea that we human beings have just about effed ourselves right off the planet. A character by the name of Rob Rivet, Robbie the Riveter, I guess, of the Pacific Legal Foundation. Necessarily, it is a right-wing outfit. And he went on Radio Rwanda and dropped the following. Check this out.
It's a go-to argument for global warming activists. Rising temperatures are killing off polar bears. And although they are on the endangered species list, our next guest says the bears are actually thriving, and having them on the list is actually costing jobs at a time we really need them. Joining us now, Rob Rivett, the president of the Pacific Legal Foundation. Rob, welcome. Tell us how the polar bears are doing.
Thank you for having me. And well, the polar bears are thriving, as you said. In fact, 50 years ago, there were only 5,000 to 10,000 of these species. Today, there are over 25,000. In fact, of the 17 populations, 14 of those populations are either maintaining their populations or increasing their populations. So there's no question that this bear is thriving. The real concern for us, of course, at Pacific Legal Foundation, is that these bears were listed, and they were listed based upon simply speculation. Let me tell you how this happened. In essence, through computer modeling, the federal government determined that this species would be losing its sea ice habitat, and because of the loss of sea ice habitat, they felt it was necessary to put them on the threatened list. But even their own computer modeling, which is very questionable, indicated that within 40 to 50 years, there would still be at least 20,000 of these species. So there's no question the species is not it's not endangered.
All right.
It is thriving right now.
And quickly, I want to ask you, I know you're taking this case all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, hoping they'll weigh in. What's the bigger impact as far as the amount of regulatory power the federal government has?
Yeah, the real problem, Shan, is that under the ESA, if a species is listed, all the activity that goes into the causing impact on the species can be regulated. Here, the argument is that CO2 emissions from industry is causing global warming. Well, industry is basically energy, food producers, transportation, all those things. And if you're going to make that more expensive through regulation, all the rest of us are going to be impacted by that. And also, jobs are going to be lost because of that. So
yeah.
Simply by listing this species, it's a real problem.
Well, we will follow this case all the way to the Supreme Court. Rob, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
You know, I'm really proud of you guys for not screaming in the middle of that.
Well, I kind of knew what you were coming. I read about it earlier. Or at least saw it on Facebook.
Yeah, I would have screamed, but I probably would have been kicked out of chat. So.
Or for all I know, you muted and screamed. But
I have learned to mask. Yeah, I have learned to mask.
Go ahead.
I've learned to mask my emotions, but here's the point. One, the man is confusing individuals with species. He says 20,000 species, not individuals. So first, he is grammatically incorrect. Secondly, there is lots of independent evidence of the polar bears starving. There was one found on the Tsavo board way up north, which was skin and bones. Why? Couldn't get onto the ice. The ice was several hundred miles to the north. So again, based on actual evidence, this is false. And why it's being done? Well, gee, if we can only have the corporations drill in the Arctic, why some executive may have extra money left over from his platinum-plated toilet seat to give to our...
Yeah, and for some reason Will kind of keeps dropping in and out. But
yeah, he's gonna have to leave pretty quick anyway.
Okay, well thank you very much, Will. Let's take this little Friday experiment a little further and see if we can tie in the actual phone lines too.
I'm gonna add Larry now too.
Okay. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob? Hello. How you doing, Bob?
Good, Jim. How are you?
All right, man, but. I just want to let you know, don't let that guy near the Hobbit, man, or he's going to have a whole bunch of scary things to worry about. Well, that trilogy, man.
Well, the other member of our Jim duo just wrote in a moment ago, Jim, and said, I love dragons, unicorns, and dwarves. A hell of a lot more than the impact of guided missiles with 10 MIRV warheads ready on launch. Jim said, I've seen these real dragons in their lair. I'll take Tolkien's Smaug character any day.
You know what you do with a unicorn that has no legs?
No.
Take him for a drag.
Ba-dum-bum. He'll be here all week. Try the veal.
No, that's just crazy, man, what these people come up with. But, you know, like you said, the old, what, there are 6,000, 7,000 years old.
Right, just slightly younger than the written recipe for beer.
Right, right. Well, that makes sense. I mean, God wouldn't put us here without beer, you know. He left that recipe right there. And
we did real good with that recipe.
Yeah.
So you can't even have a conversation with these people. Forget that. I mean, I told you about the woman. She mentioned to me, I wrote a poem for a girl once and at this place I was working, and, oh, poetry, and right away she gets her off on the, what's that part in the Bible? I've never read the Bible.
Good man.
I'm familiar with it, but what's the part that's written nothing but love poems by King Solomon?
Oh, yeah, Song of Songs, or Song of Solomon, as it's called.
Something like that. So she's trying to connect with me. Oh, there's a part in the Bible that's nothing but King Solomon's prayer. It's love poems to his wives. I go, yeah, wives. Isn't that the one I had 350 wives? You know, that shut her up pretty quick.
Yeah, which wife?
Because
there were like 500 of them.
You ain't plaguing these, all right?
Yeah, I got two wives, and it's mighty big of me.
Yeah. Well, if you can handle it, if you got the money and the time.
Bill just wrote in from Cleveland and said, the only dragon I'm interested in is a drag on that reefer.
Do you think, by the way, do you think basic decriminalization will ever come around in our lifetime, or you think it's just going to be state by state?
It's going to be state by state. And see, because there are vast sums of federal dollars involved, the DEA will go kicking and screaming.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, I was thinking that years ago. I mean, that's the big part of it. I mean, everything's, the whole government is just getting financing, and that's why you got to build up the big cases for the horrible, you know, reefers, opposed to folk, you know, and they focus, where there's much more worse things to worry about, like, I guess, crystal meth. But, you know, you can't, like, focus on that. You got to keep the weed in there, too, and also you keep the drug testing industry alive, which is a big scam, you know. Just about every damn job you go to, you got to take a, you know, at least pee in a bottle or something.
Of course, you wonder what will happen in places like Colorado and Washington now.
Oh, I was thinking about that yesterday when you were talking to, the guy from Hawaii.
Oh, yeah.
He's from New Orleans, yeah.
Yeah, Kenny.
Yeah, and I was thinking about that. That's got to be a big part of it too, because once you start getting that money, people do strange things for money, you know.
There's strange and then there's stupid. People do stupid things for money too.
And pure evil too. I mean, you know, keep a war going, start a war. Keep a war going. I mean,
it's Friday. I wonder. It's Friday, and it's the middle of the month. I wonder if it's payday for those cops, those Arlington, Texas cops who raided the tomatoes.
Yeah, that was another weird story.
Well, speaking of someone who lives in the city,
go ahead, Sergi.
Speaking of someone who lives in the city of which Arlington is a suburb, honestly, that sounds like 100% genuine Arlington right there. That place is backwards as I do not know what.
To the point of not knowing the difference between a tomato and a pot plant, Sergi? Really?
Let me go ahead and tell... tell y'all a little bit about Arlington. Arlington is a suburb of Fort Worth. It's in between Fort Worth and Dallas, but it's closer to Fort Worth. Arlington is a generally, yes, they are that backwards to where they could confuse plants like that, because, I mean, they still hold the view that, oh, well, if we allow the Fort Worth Transportation Authority to send buses and trains in here, it'll bring criminals in.
And which so is, of course, code for black people.
Exactly. And Arlington holds the dubious distinction of being the largest city on earth with no public transit. 450,000 people and not a single bus stop. And it's all because of backwards attitudes like that. They think, you know, they think in that code. It's not so much black people as poor people, because there's lots of rich black people in Arlington who hold that view.
Really?
Oh, yes. See, here, it's not so much about race as it is about class. Over there in Arlington, you got rich whites, rich blacks, rich Hispanics, and rich Asians who all hold that view that we don't want buses here because it'll bring in the criminals and the poor.
It's
they
true.
Just don't like the poor.
Yeah, so, but wait, how does their help get to work? I mean, you can't tell me they're mowing their own lawns or what's left of them, Sergi.
They generally have their help living with them, so. They have a lot of those mansions over there in Arlington. They have those little sub houses tucked away in the back, far in the backyard somewhere. That's where the help is.
So wait, how much do they pay the help?
I don't know.
As little as possible.
Yeah, I'm sure as little as possible.
Yeah, you have, hi there, it's Larry. You have, families that will have people that will come from, other countries like Mexico and what have you, and they'll live in, and they'll keep, and they'll clean the house and take care of the kids and all that. And they, and, you know, back in the 60s, they get maybe $50 to $100 a month, plus the room and board, and they also, you know, they're also, they're, so they become part of the family that way. They're not seen by the family members, or at least in my experience, not seen by the family members as though they're, you know, less than or lower than. They just become part of the family.
Well,
so I don't know if that's what happens there.
Oh, no. Over there in Arlington, they are considered the help. They are not considered part of the family. And, you know, Arlington overall, my overall point, it's a backwards place, you know, and they definitely, I would not put it past their police department to do stuff like that.
So what you're saying is kind of like that movie, The Help, where, you know, you have somebody coming from out of the area, you know, in this case it was, Jim Crow, the South, and you'd have your people, you'd have people coming in to do the domestic work, for the family, but they weren't considered part of the family. And they were treated like, you know, like they were non-people. And what you're saying is that am I hearing you correctly, Sergi?
Pretty much. I've never seen that movie because I'm not much of a movie watcher, but it definitely, yeah, it's pretty much what I'm saying. That's pretty much the way, but that and the overall point of, you know, that whole police raid, that's classic Arlington right there. They do stuff like that all the time. It just doesn't make the national news.
But you know what? One thing arises out of all this, by the way that you describe Arlington, Sergi, they have achieved true integration. Because if you're rich and Asian, or rich and Hispanic, or rich and black, or rich and white, you can all live together in harmony.
Pretty much. That's the way it works. And it's not just Arlington. We have plenty of little suburbs that are like that. South Lake, Keller, Flower Mound, all these places. And you go to these places, and all the houses are McMansions that look the same. And, you know, you got, you know, just plenty of Stepford. It's pretty much that whole Stepford kind of thing, but except that they're not all white. It's all about rich trying to keep the poor out.
Well, see, we've reached a post-racial America.
Yeah, well, Jesse Jackson said that about the color. The color is green now. That, yeah, years ago, I think I remember that, something to that effect.
Yeah. It's the...
And
yeah.
Our, Oh, sorry.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It doesn't matter what as long as you're making enough money to be able to fit into that money class, or you have the same kind of cultural and social values and economic values of that particular group, they'll take you.
Pretty much, that's the way it works, at least in around the suburbs here. And it's not even just the suburbs, a lot of the rich urban neighborhoods are kind of like that too. Although the buses run through them because they ain't got no say in that. But as for the suburbs that do have service, you know, you still have that kind of like minority of people that have that view. Like, I remember when Dallas area rapid transit was about to open their green line, which starts in the suburb of Carrollton, runs through Farmers Branch, the heart of Dallas, and it ends in a district of Dallas that's known as Pleasant Grove. And Pleasant Grove is one of those stereotypical, you know, quote unquote ghettos. And I'll never forget seeing this letter to the editor in the Dallas Morning News saying, basically, that person having a fear of, they'll ride the train up from Buckner Station and rob me here in Carrollton. And I immediately went on Twitter and I tweeted, really? They're going to use a train as a getaway vehicle? Really? I mean, you can just see the silliness of their arguments by imagining the scenario. Somebody gets on a train, waits for a train in Pleasant Grove, waits 45 minutes, because, you know, it's a big county, 45 minutes to get up to Carrollton, walks around to Case, goes in, walks out with the big screen television, and just walks conspicuously down the street, waits at downtown Farmers Branch Station or downtown Carrollton, and rides back.
Yeah, the whole idea of Casey Jones as Wheelman. That's beautiful. Just beautiful.
And, you know, it's the attitude around here, you know. It's just, it's crazy.
I take it it's not like a subway system.
It's a light rail. Like, the soil here in North Texas is much too rocky clay, you know, it's much too hard and prohibitively expensive to dig. They were actually going to do subways here, but it was prohibitively expensive. So we have the above ground light rail, which some parts of the city, like downtown, it runs street level. Other parts, there is one station where they sent it underground. It's City Place Station. And the reason they have to send it underground is because they couldn't exactly demolish their way through uptown Dallas to build the rail line. So they had to go underground. That's the only subway part of it. And most of it, though, is elevated. Most of it's elevated. It's a pretty good system.
So it's kind of like L in Chicago?
Basically, yes, except that it's overhead light rail rather than the heavy rail.
Hey guys, let's see what happens here. I'm going to go ahead and be adventuresome and try to bring another caller online alongside Jim. So
okay, I'm going to bring Jason in.
Okay. Hey, welcome to the program.
Oh, Bob, I just saw a killer tomato roll past my window.
Oh my God, we've got Jim and Jim over here.
That's right, and also Santa Claus fighting the Martians.
Without a doubt.
Killers. Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Well, just fine,
hey,
Jim.
How you doing, Jim?
So,
hey, Jim.
What's up?
Another day in paradise.
Oh, I see. Well, that's the way it is.
I picked a bucket full of tomatoes last night. None of them were killer.
They were
good.
I was going to say, but were they awesome?
I'd like to have some of them.
They're awesome.
Well, at least the fire department here hasn't been summoned out with the National Guard to fight the killer tomatoes that they were talking about in Texas.
Yeah, well, the one thing, having lived next door to a legal, permitted medical marijuana grow, the one thing is when they flower, the smell is something else.
And well, yeah, I smell those too. And
so the only way you can smell a tomato plant is get down and get your hands into it.
That's
and
right.
Once you pick, the smell is all over your hands. You can smell.
Yeah, and it's not a lovely smell.
No.
Well, I mean, I've been growing some tomatoes, real tomatoes, and I'm still curious. I mean, going back to that, I do not see how anybody with a rudimentary understanding of botany could mistake tomato plants for pot. I mean, I've had a little experience with pot, and doesn't smell like pot, doesn't even look like, to me.
Well, that's just been a word. That's just anybody would say something like that about a tomato plant or a tomato plant. I mean, I don't know what they were smoking before they went in there and saw these alleged pot producing tomatoes or tomatoes or.
I'm trying to come up with a neologism for that. Are we talking about?
Well, let's call the whole thing off. Yeah. You say potato.
Well, I say potato. I guess I'm asking, are these pot-matoes then?
I guess so.
Yeah, see, maybe it's that bioengineering or that stuff that they've been doing over at, what's that company, the big that's mixing the genes with everything. You have the tomato, the pot tomato, tomato pot.
I want some pot tomatoes.
Eat your salad and get high.
Man. Yeah, that raises the bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich to a whole new level. Which, by the way, let me just throw this in there as a unpaid recommendation. I've mentioned Benton's Bacon a couple of times now. I'm eagerly awaiting the day that my package arrives now. But it's
how many weeks ago did you order it?
A week. But they make this stuff themselves. And it's a very small operation.
Well, I read their disclaimer. It says it may take 3 weeks to get an order.
I know. And I'm just hoping there's still tomatoes by then, fresh tomatoes.
See on Facebook that Cold River Mountain Watch has got a garden.
Yeah, they do. And frankly, but just between us, it's just between us. I worry about that because, of course, the headquarters of Cold River Mountain Watch isn't in some faraway city, nowhere near mountaintop removal and all the dust and the poisons. It's right underneath a mountaintop removal site. So we know that the soils are contaminated with polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon toxins. That gives me some concern. I mean, would it you?
Well, you can always use that garden as a benchmarking garden, see all the pollutants have accrued in there.
Has anybody ever checked a vegetable garden for pollution like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing that the United States Geological Survey did, Duncan. They tested the soil itself and said, yeah, the soils, your garden soils are loaded with PAH toxins.
So how far does that go for?
But did they take the next step and say it's in the food you're growing?
That testing is not complete.
That's my where mm-hmm. I was going.
Although it is not unreasonable to think that with its availability in the soil that it would be bio uptake. And I mean, consider how beans draw nitrogen out of the soil. Now, if my reasoning is faulty, please tell me. But if you put fertilizer on the ground, it dissolves into the soil and the plant takes it up, and that's why fertilizer is fertilizer, right?
Right.
Right.
Yeah, but what I was going to say a minute ago is if anybody has the inclination, I would just love to hear somebody else's opinion on Benton's Bacon if they get their hands on it. In fact, it really blew my mind. Last time I was in D.C., there's a tavern there that closed and reopened, and it's called the Hawk and Dove. And, Jim, I'll bet you know where that is.
Let me see.
Up on Pennsylvania Avenue, past, up on Capitol Hill on Pennsylvania Avenue, past the Capitol and Library of Congress and all of that.
You know, Bob, I don't remember the place, to tell you the truth. There's so many places in Washington to eat and stuff like that. I guess that's one I may have missed or just forgotten about.
Well, it's kind of an iconic place, but they closed and reopened, and lo and behold, they feature, I forget what it was, I was looking at their menu one evening. They feature a dish that they specifically note is made with Benton's Bacon.
Oh, God, D.C. is a gastronomic paradise. I mean, there are so many things and, you know, so many wonderful things that you can, so many wonderful comestibles and things like that that are available to the consumer and the tourist or whomever. And as a one-time resident, yeah, I enjoyed a lot of good food in D.C. But Benton's Bacon, I don't know about it. I haven't heard it.
Well, it's a little teeny tiny operation out of East Tennessee.
Okay.
And I first was turned on to it by a friend of mine when I went down to Knoxville about the, October last year. And it was, no, it was December, I guess. And it's a big deal. I mean, the restaurants will put, you know, we serve Benton's Bacon. And so she then told me where to go to buy some to bring home. And I did, and the tribe here fell on it like a pack of wolves. That's all I can say.
Wow.
I mean, it has.
Last bacon I had was turkey bacon, but that's not, I guess.
Yeah, that's food porn of a different sort, Jim. That's more like an abomination.
Yeah, it's edible, but not the real thing, I guess. But nonetheless.
Well, I mean, the price that they charge for this stuff is not that bad. It's 4 pounds for $25, I think. And by the time you work in shipping, it works out to be about $9 a pound. But good God, you know, just Benton's Bacon. And just to, just to take a half a slice of this stuff and use it to season a pot of green beans or a pot of brown beans, holy mackerel! Or God knows, turnip greens.
Well, it sounds very, very appetizing. Very much so.
Well, if anybody does decide to write off, send them a note in the order and say, "Hey, I heard this guy talking about you on the radio."
Is this you can order it online?
Yeah, if you just do a search for Benton's Bacon.
They
also do hams, but they had a setback because one of their smokehouses burned down. So that may be a part of the problem with the turnaround time.
I hate when that happens and the smokehouse burns down.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well,
no smoking in the smokehouse, damn it.
I guess somebody really got smoked when it burned down. What can you say? That's really regrettable. Goodness.
Maybe they had some of those hot tomatoes, those marijuana tomatoes.
Well, I prefer the killer tomatoes. Those are the ones I like in that movie. I used to get real stoned and watch that movie and just have a wonderful time. That coupled with Santa Claus versus the Martians.
Yeah, that's an all-time classic, Santa Claus versus the Martians.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, it's just incredible. But anyway, hey, whatever people want to believe in or whatever, whether it's... Oh, I don't know. Like I said in my email to you about dwarves and dragons and other critters, I wish I had a great big white luck dragon that I could fly around on, like in the Never Ending Story.
Falcor.
Yeah, you know, I love mysticism. I love fantasy. I love a lot of things that people don't normally think that, you know, I should be thinking about at my age, but still, that's just a part of my own child that I just enjoy very much, and stories written by, for example, the Ring Trilogy by Tolkien. I mean, Tolkien was an extremely intelligent man and devout Catholic, and he used many of these things as in the metaphorical sense.
Well, sure. And you know, that's the nature of myth. After all, Tolkien started, the Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit all began as a combination between bedtime stories for his children and a philological exercise in myth creation, because his particular philological specialty were the Icelandic sagas.
Well, not to mention the fact that also the time in which he lived. Of course, you're talking about World War One. And the things that happened there. And I think he was basically making reference to a lot of evil in this world and making it, I guess, a little more palatable, acceptable, or maybe realistic in his own mind to his readers and his children, because I do believe he told these stories to his children.
He did. They started out as bedtime stories.
And, you know, and I love all those stories, and I just think they're wonderful. And, and I am excited, not excited, but am pleased and amused and also gratified now at my tender age of X number of years as I was 30 years ago.
Sure. It's timeless. And, you know, you mentioned the sort of era in which that all he begins to craft that story. Well, you know, you can certainly see a parallel between his forebodings of the rise of the necromancer, who is later identified as the Dark Lord, who is Sauron, who was beaten and then is returning. You know, that's the beating and remilitarization of Germany.
Well, the defeat of Adolf Hitler, and of course the return of the Fourth Reich through various means that they had intended, by diverting currency through Swiss banks and all kinds of stuff in the world, and going to Argentina and different areas. I mean, these things just seem to basically continue to survive in spite of the ruins of Berlin and, you know, the end of the Japanese Greater Coast Prosperity Sphere, as they called it at one time. I mean, these things just never die out. They always continue in some means to survive, and that's just the way of it is.
Oh, speaking of, you mentioned the Japanese Empire. Sparky, I did get around to watching Emperor.
Oh, you did, huh? What'd you think of it?
Mixed feelings. I thought it was a good story and a compelling story. And then, of course, I had to ruin it for myself by going and looking up the historical Bonner Fellers, who was the central character of the movie.
Yeah.
turns out he was a hardcore member of the John Birch Society.
Oh, after the war?
Yeah.
Hmm. And who is this emperor? I'm not familiar with this. I'm sorry.
Well, it's kind of, Jim, it's a romance that's based upon the process leading up to MacArthur's decision to not prosecute Hirohito for war crimes.
Oh, the emperor. Oh, the Japanese emperor. It is. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm familiar with that. Okay, that's the emperor.
Tommy Lee Jones plays MacArthur.
Which I thought he did a magnificent job with.
He does a pretty good job of most of the roles that he plays. You know, the thing about Hirohito that amazes me is the fact that I think, number one, he was basically outvoted by the war cabinet, because I don't think Hirohito wanted to go to war. But once they decided to do that, and correct me if I'm wrong, I guess he kind of had to go along. But then after the war, his specialties were, of all things, marine biology. And he was quite accomplished in that area of science.
Somebody's got some return coming back to us in the background. If you could check your speakers or something.
No, mine are fine. Mine are off.
No, but I mean, somebody.
That me? Are you all right with me?
Yeah, you seem good, Jim.
Okay.
It might be Larry or Jason.
No, my mic was muted.
Okay.
But might be Larry.
Well, it seems to have gone away now.
Okay.
Well, just moving along to a couple of other stories. And by the way, it tickles me pink to have this actually work. Because Friday on the Front Porch was conceived as a means of bringing, you know, of really getting a genuine multi-person conversation going.
Well, we gave it a test flight last New Year's Eve.
Yeah, and you know, I think people need to know that it is through your good offices and your good efforts, Duncan, that this happens, because, you know, you've been moderating this group for how long?
5 years.
And so anybody who would like, and some form of conversation takes place in this group almost every night after Malloy.
And Voice on Fridays.
And Voice on Fridays. So if anybody wants to jump in, shoot a note to me with your contact information. I'll provide it to Duncan, and he'll get in touch and walk you through the process for joining in this little because it's a blast. It really, really is a blast. And for the most part, I've been really pleased with the audio quality.
Is this telephonic or by Skype?
It's on Skype, Jim.
Okay.
Yeah.
But Bob, have you heard about? I guess you have, but I've heard this on Malloy's show about you know the Fukushima, and it's like I commented the other day on his show about how it's been to me almost a news blackout. I mean, you heard a little bit about a week or so when it happened, then you heard a little bit about the 1 year anniversary. But except for his show, and maybe I missed it on yours, about how that's not a good situation.
No, I've had a couple of those. Kate brought it to my reminded me, just gave me a little email tickle to say don't let this story go unreported, and I've mentioned it a couple of times in the last week or so. There's a horror unfolding over there that is not being reported on.
Well, I have a friend who lives here, whose brother lives in Tokyo, and he's reported the same thing to me vis-a-vis his brother.
And I guess in Japan, and our buddy Robert in Kitakyushu might be able to speak to this a little bit at some point, and maybe I just conjured him. But I guess they're scared of starting a panic, one. And two, well, it's bad for business.
Yeah, but that stuff's going to be coming. It's in the ocean. It's radioactivity just doesn't stay where you want it. It has a way of going where it wants.
It does have a mind of its own, doesn't it?
It's read my mind, Jim.
And the thing is, the last article I saw pointed out that it's no longer just tritium; it's strontium.
Well, strontium 90 is something just of the calcium family, and that really loves to get into milk and stuff like that. Strontium 90 is, oh boy, you don't want to deal with that.
And cesium?
Has anybody taken a good look at the ocean currents and kind of calculated how long it's going to take that to make it to the West Coast?
I think we can scientifically say not long.
I think I heard the other night that was one of the things he was kind of talking about, or that it was getting spreading out, moving instead of moving on out. It's inevitable. It's still, I can't see.
And the thing is, it's hundreds of thousands of gallons of this water per day.
It took about 6 months for the debris to start washing up on the shores of Hawaii, so.
Well, they've been getting all kinds of debris on the Oregon and California coast.
Well, the radiation's going to be right along with it, I'd assume. Soon.
And remember, the half-life of the half-life of strontium 90, or is it 90 or 91, Jim?
91.
Is 26 years.
Yeah, strontium 90. Yeah, it was 26 years, absolutely. Like I say, my first exposure to strontium 90 was in the eighth grade when I was read by my eighth grade teacher this book or this magazine type of subscription called Alast Babylon. And I think one of your callers years ago mentioned that particular thing because she and I must have been contemporaries. Or our contemporaries, and it was about a nuclear war and how strontium 90 and these other radioactive elements would continue to do their deadly work and to basically substitute themselves for less benevolent elements in the periodic table. But nonetheless, that was my first exposure to it. It was in the eighth grade. It scared me half to death, too. And, of course, the situational
something of the last Babylon occurred in Florida around Orlando in the aftermath of the nuclear war. And that's the reason I mentioned to you earlier as far as these dragons and dwarves and things of that nature, unicorns. I would prefer them any day to the ones that I've seen and have read the capabilities of doing in X number of, 15-minute segments, you know?
Yeah. Did you ever go to Southeast Asia, Jim?
Yeah, I did.
Were you in Thailand?
Life I just don't discuss, but I will tell you this.
Did you ever see some of the big lizards over there?
Yeah, sure did. Saw a couple, not too many. The ones that I were worried about had 2 feet, not four, but nonetheless. But it's one of the most beautiful country in the world. If you like hot weather, if you like being in 120 degree heat, and also, but in Dalat, up in the upper parts of Annam or Vietnam, mm-hmm. It's near where the Montagnards lived and things of that nature, and they were very good people. And Teddy Roosevelt even had a hunting lodge up there.
Which, I never knew that.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did. He did. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I went.
I was there in like. I will just be honest with you, in like an unofficial capacity, and I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, okay. Well, I was stationed in Thailand.
Well, that's a beautiful country too.
Yeah, I was at Utapao Air Base.
Oh yeah.
And we had a notorious big lizard that lived in the Kluang. Everybody called it the Kluang Monster.
Oh, and the canals.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are lots of those around, those Komodo dragon lizards are something you don't want to mess with, are those big lizards, because God knows if you ever get bitten by one, I don't even know if you can get to a doctor quick enough to kill the infection, because their mouths are so deadly.
Yeah, all they do is bite something, and they follow the blood trail until you die.
Exactly, and you basically are infected to the point that you are overcome by whatever it is they carry in their oral cavities. Yeah, it's just, they are not pretty things.
We've got those things down here on the west coast of Florida. Those Komodo dragon lizards.
Oh, good Lord, you can have those critters.
Is that because people have had them for, have bought them for pets and then found out and then just turned them loose, kind of like the pythons?
I'm not sure
about that. You know, that's the damnedest thing I ever heard of, how people can sell these snakes and stuff like that, and yet a 15-foot, 100-pound snake can escape through, however it did, into an upper room of a house and kill two small boys. Not trying to drift away from the subject of Komodo dragon lizards, but, I just can't understand how anybody could house something like that as a pet.
Yeah. Yeah, but they don't. Yeah, I'm not. I can't wrap my head around the idea of fetch the tennis ball, fetch the stick with the Komodo dragon, or any. Let's be inclusive and all encompassing. Any monitor lizard.
Or I'll say this: pythons too. That's
we had
something.
A,
I mean,
yeah, I don't know if it's specifically the Komodo dragon. There is monitor lizards in South Florida on the West Coast. So you got to watch out for them suckers.
We had a 26-foot python at the base in Thailand in a cage that they fed chickens to. It was next to a beer garden.
We got a bunch of them down here, too, in the Everglades.
Yeah, so
they actually pay people to go in there and find them and kill them.
Right, because they're an invasive species. They're non-native.
Yeah.
But a snake won't eat until it's hungry. I mean, they used to throw the chicken in that cage with that snake and be in there for days. You drive by there and you look over at the cage and the chicken would still be running around that cage and the snake hadn't ate it yet. And then the next day you go there and the chicken was gone.
To me, that is the most offensive to my sensibilities of anything in the world. is to, number one, have something like that in a cage, and number two, have people or who want to see it take its prey. I mean, that's just something that I never could quite get into. It's sort of redolent of cockfighting or something like that. I don't know. I just...
Well, there's what happens in nature, and then there's what happens for amusement, and the dividing line is not very narrow at all.
Well, I didn't get into the amusement part.
Yeah.
It's what they did to the chicken before they threw it in the snake's cage.
It's kind of like some sort of, if you think about it, pornography, you know, animal porn or something, see another animal eat another.
You know? I agree. Now, that's a good point. That's a damn good point.
I mean, for instance, I mean, what occurs in nature, I mean, you know what a capybara is, right? It's a giant ass guinea pig, and it lives in the wetlands of Venezuela and that area.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And the giant anaconda is, you know, it's the size of a pig. And an anaconda will come along and just, you know, goodbye capybara.
And the anaconda will look like it's pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
After it ingests that thing, and you know, it's just sort of I don't know. I'm sort of like Harrison Ford in the Indiana Jones things.
Why has it always got to be snakes?
Why does it have to be snakes? God knows I hate those things. I mean, I leave them alone and I don't bother them. They won't bother me, and normally they're pretty much a get out of the way thing, except I have been in situations in which you have to be real careful, because if you do happen to step on the wrong one, you got about two more steps, and you got a problem.
Well, you know, one of the more obnoxious poisonous snakes that's not supposed to be in West Virginia. We're supposed to only have to deal with copperheads and rattlesnakes here. Well, we now have water moccasins, cottonmouths.
Water moccasins?
Oh,
they will
God.
Chase your ass.
You're from Texas, and you don't know what a water moccasin is, Sergi?
Let me involve him with my accident on that.
You get in the water with them, and they will chase you.
One of the most horrifying scenes I've ever seen in film or read in literature is in Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove, where they're crossing the Red River with their herd, and one of the ranch hands, cowhands, runs afoul of a nest of water moccasins.
That's what they are. They nest together, and they're extremely aggressive, and also in addition to being aggressive, I don't mean to interrupt you, Bob, but they are extremely curious.
Yeah.
Whereas most times, most snakes will, if you can give them time to leave, they'll split. But water moccasins, no, and God knows, if you've ever looked at one and seen it open its mouth, it's just as white as snow.
Yeah, that's where they get the cottonmouth name.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's their technical name. Well, their technical name is probably some mumbo-jumbo scientific junk, but yeah. I've heard them called.
But we're not supposed to have them here. We're not supposed to have them here, but we do have them here now. And in fact, more particularly to my discomfort, there's a little creek that runs through my daughter and her husband's yard down at the bottom of the hill, and they tend to nest under that bank.
Oh yeah, they do, and they can get into a private pond or whatever. And once you've got them in a private pond, or you know, like if you want a pond for fishing or recreation, son, you've got a problem, because those things are highly prolific. I mean, they are just. They're hard to deal with. They really are.
Yeah, and they'll rear up and they'll open that big white mouth up and just, I'll probably have bad dreams now.
Well, you know.
Bob, do you know what the best solution to that is?
What?
Get yourself some really big, full-grown black snakes. It's also referred to as king snakes.
Mm-hmm.
And turn them loose. They will eat the deadly snakes' eggs and babies.
Yeah, and that's the thing. A lot of people mistake a king snake for a water moccasin. And a king snake is an entirely benevolent creature.
Yeah,
absolutely. It all it eats is rats and other snake eggs and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that.
Mm-hmm.
They will get rid of the poisonous snakes if you get one in your, you know, import one and set it loose.
I remember years ago seeing a buddy of mine. We were out playing golf back when I played golf, and he wound up standing next to a black snake in the middle of the fairway. And bless his heart, you know, he was a big time hunter, and you know, but didn't like to kill just to be killing. Ate everything he killed. Took out the longest iron that he had, and he had a driving iron, a one iron, and just gently picked that black snake up and took him over. He said, you know, I'm going to take him over somewhere he's going to find better hunting. And took him over into the rough by the Cole River. And dropped him there. And meanwhile, I was staying as far away from it all as possible because I have the creeping horrors too.
Yeah, but well, if anybody kills a black snake, they're doing themselves a disservice because they will keep the poisonous snake population way down.
Oh, and by the way, I had a note in from Marty. He said, I do believe, going back to Japan and Fukushima for a moment, Marty says, I do believe that there are reports the rad levels in the San Diego, Southern California beach area have been on the rise.
Yeah, that's kind of what I heard, something to that effect, and that, if you just, like I say, just think of it, it's dominoes. It's, you know, you set up dominoes, one hits the other, and it just keeps on going. I don't see where this ends, you know? I mean, unless that preacher guy you had on, you're talking about, you were planning the other day, I'm sure he's got some magic.
Oh, God, and I got another story from him.
Oh, my God.
We're talking about Chappie Klingenschmidt.
Yeah, that's the
John Jacob Dingleheimer Schmidt.
Yeah, his name is my name too. Yeah.
Did you see Tu Wong Fu?
Oh, absolutely.
That's where I figured you'd seen Robin Williams do that character when his compass was pointing toward north with those two drag queens played by Wesley Snipes and Patrick Swayze. What a wonderful movie!
I love that film.
It's about, you know, the reason I liked it so much is it's not about the drag thing. But it's about these guys go into a village, Snydersville, and they one of them beats the shit out of a wife beating husband, and it's just the whole thing of the movie. Not to get away from what we're talking about, was the fact it was about people helping people without prejudice.
Yeah, the curative power of tolerance.
Exactly, and the sheriff who was tracing them and this, that, and the other with a glass shoe or whatever the hell it was, but nonetheless, it was, I still watch that movie every time I can see it.
And well, Jim, speaking of things along the same lines, I know that you are more of a fan of the Olympics probably than I.
Oh, definitely I am.
Well, where do you find yourself on in regard to the growing calls for a boycott over the rampant homophobia and outright persecution taking place in Russia?
I don't want to see a repeat of 1980. I do not want to see that happen because I think basically Russia is in a country that is in a state of finding itself, and I would hate to see the Olympics boycotted there. I really would. Now, basically, what I said the Russians will probably do will be like it happened in the 11th Olympiad in 1936 in Berlin, when basically they put all their prejudices away for the tourists to see, and it was a spectacular Olympic Games. It was one of the best shows ever devised in history.
The interesting thing about that, all that homophobia comes back from the Russian Orthodox Church and the freedom of the, now, you know, since you don't have the Communist Party there anymore, you have the rise of another evil community or another religion, but it's,
you had a number of communists and stuff like that when communism, first came into being in the early 20s and things like that, in which there were, yeah, right, 20s, thank you, in which there was a lot of prejudice against that. And so, I mean, you have some prejudices that don't go away. They had an incident now in Orthodox Church when these girls would go into the sanctuary.
Yeah, Pussy Riot.
And that caused a lot of problems, and I really hated to see that happen.
because I think they really hurt more than they helped. Because I mean, Russia is in a
good
spot.
I'm sorry. It was subtitles, and I can't keep up with subtitles.
Oh,
well, then let's examine it from this perspective. Then, okay, so no boycott.
In my opinion, no boycott. I would hate to see that happen because I mean
What then about people who, you know, because the International Olympic Committee has this purist ban on manifestations of political speech or anything like that. What about those people who want to go and use their presence at the games as a form of protest and say something that violates the Russian law as an act of civil disobedience?
Well, that's going to be handled by the host country. I mean, for example, back in 1972, we had similar problems with black athletes making a fist instead of a salute when they mounted the Olympic podium.
That was 68 in Mexico City, Dr. John Carlos.
Oh, yeah, wherever it was. I remember that. But, you know, I would just like to see the Olympics completely divorced from all of this stuff. And I would hope that the people who are in the seats of power in the Kremlin or wherever they are, I mean, they spend a lot of money. They spend a lot of time and effort to basically provide, I hope, a clean place for sport. And I am, unlike Bob, I guess, the Olympics are something that I just really, I don't get into football or baseball or whatever, but the Olympics are very special to me, and I hate that this is happening. And I don't think that the Russian Orthodox Church, the vote is out with that as far as I'm concerned.
Well, the Olympics were completely perceived as something that was supposed to put everything else aside and just have competition.
Exactly.
Among athletes.
All war was put aside in ancient Sparta or Greece or wherever. There was a peace treaty or a moratorium on any type of conflict. And if I'm not mistaken, Bob, you're the ancient history specialist here. But, you know, basically it was a time in which all that was put aside and people were allowed to come together in the spirit of the sport of festivity or the festivity of sport, excuse me, and to excel at what they've been training for years.
Yeah, but in World War II, during the height of World War II, I doubt there was an Olympics in 44, probably not even in 40.
No, the 36th Olympics were held in Berlin, the 11th Olympiad. And then, of course, they were supposed to be held in Tokyo. And then, of course, they were postponed in 44. And then the next Olympics in 48 were held in London.
Hey, by the way, everybody, just got a note in from Kate. The subject line reads, "This brings up fond memories." And she says, "Hey, gang, this is just like it used to be. First, let me thank y'all who got us out of the July hole." And then she goes on with regard to something you mentioned, Jim. She said, "Alas, Babylon has been on my shelf for years. It goes a long way to explain how we are going to survive end times." And I don't think Kate by no means means end times like, you know, Revelations. The real problems.
She says,
"Note that Malmstrom Air Force Base, just 100 miles north of me, failed an inspection on the nukes. Minot, North Dakota, failed 2 years ago, too." And then she says, "Duncan, did you say 6 years? I can remember when you first introduced yourself. I think it had to do with union business." And she said, "This connection is another reason we started the front porch. So many folks are missing from the porch, but you folks are making up for their absence." And then just as a kind request, a polite request from Kate, "It would be nice if y'all would discuss something other than snakes. This is as icky as Sergi's bugs."
Well, you tell Kate I said this. In honor of Cole Porter, kiss me, Kate.
So I guess don't bring up that movie Snakes on a Plane?
And we are also not going to bring up the fact that Mark just wrote in to answer, I think it was Jason's question, the actual name for a water moccasin or a cottonmouth is Agkistrodon piscivorous. Hooked tooth fish eater.
There we go.
So we're not going to bring that up either.
Okay.
And then Kate says, thanks again to everyone who contributed these past few weeks. Let's keep it going. August is an extra long month. Signed, Kate on the Front Range. Of course, she's absolutely right. We started out needing to raise $195 tonight, and we have raised, in fact, precisely zero. And just as an added note, it looks like September is going to be busy, and October is going to be absolutely crazy too. I'm going back to Wisconsin the first week of September. And then I'm eagerly anticipating my first ever trip to Texas the second week of September. And, of course, both of these have to do with mountaintop removal and the AIC Act. So that's why I'll be on the road.
Texas? You going to Dallas?
Going to Waco.
It's weird. You should go by Dealey Plaza. I was coming back from Seattle, and I was driving, and went through Dallas. So I went by Dealey Plaza, and you'd be surprised how small that that little area is, where the book depository.
It's just a turn off the main drive. It's just a turn, basically.
Yeah, I love, and once again, bringing up the prophet Bill Hicks, I loved what he said about it, because he said, when you go up to the top of the book depository, it's all walled off, so you can't get actually near the window. And he said he realized that that's because if you did, you'd pull your head, after you looked out the window, you'd pull your head back in and go, that ain't freaking possible.
Especially the Russian bolt action rifle. What did the Russians call
it? No, it was a Mannlicher. It was a Mannlicher, wasn't it?
It was an Italian rifle.
Yeah, Mannlicher.
Yeah, but the nickname for it was the humanitarian gun or something, because it couldn't hit anything.
The humanitarian rifle. Jesus.
Oh, my Lord.
Oh. It's
they've got that pulled off.
No, but I'm going to be going down to Waco to talk about the AIC Act and mountaintop removal. I've been kindly invited down there by Dr. Allen, who you've heard me refer to a number of times. He is a part of, among other things, a really dedicated peace group down there, and so I'll be going down and we'll be talking about the AIC Act and hopefully getting people motivated to speak to their members of Congress and get build more support for ending the Appalachian apocalypse.
Well, how's that going? I mean, does it seem to be gathering steam? It seems like it is, but I mean,
yeah, it is. The biggest problem we face are twofold. One is the same problem every effort faces, and that is to come up with the resources with which to do the work. And the second is time and money, time. Because for the most part, there are some people who have done work up there as well, but the vast majority of it has been done primarily by my colleague Bo Webb, and secondarily by my family and me. Bo has by far done much, much more of the heavy lifting. And has spent more time up there, but what we need then, since we are limited in terms of human resources on the ground in D.C., we really, really have to have these bold pushes by people in different parts of the country to get their congressperson on board. For instance, I was really, really tickled to be able to announce that Mike Capuano of Massachusetts had signed on, and that is Lottie's congressman. And Mike Capuano is on board because, A, Lottie worked strenuously to, and he wouldn't take no for an answer. And that's one of the tricks to this effort, because they write back and say, well, we're not sure, or thank you for telling us, or thank you for writing us. And Lottie wrote back and said, well, no, I'm really serious. I want my congressman on this bill, because this is the only bill that will end this horror that we would never permit in Massachusetts. So why do we allow allow poverty communities in West Virginia to be subjected to it? And June, Ferg? Yeah. Ferg and Doodle and I were up there. And we took a meeting in Representative Capuano's office, and what, just 2-3 weeks ago, we got the good news that he was signing on, and he has signed on. And so that's, you know, that's the kind of work it takes. So that's what makes going and talking to people in Wisconsin, because you know, for instance, there's one of our buddies up there has worked with real dedication to bring his congressman Ron Kind on board. We've had notes sent to Gwen Moore to bring her on board, and we're going to work even, and that's part of going back up there again.
Well, Bob, let me ask you a question, if I may, please.
Sure.
What exactly are your strategy, or is your strategy, when you go into these congressmen's office? I mean, do you call them and make an appointment first, and do you just knock on the door?
Oh, no, no, no. The appointment process is as Byzantine as you probably imagine it is, Jim. It's a matter of writing to the scheduler, and then they write back and say the congressman isn't available, and then you write back and say, yeah, but if you'll read my note, you'll note that I wrote or one of his or her aides, and they write back and say, oh, yes, I'm sorry, I missed that. And then you write back and you say, so when do we meet? And they say, I'll put you in touch with his legislative assistant. I mean, no kidding. Getting one meeting with one member of Congress can take all day long and an email and you know, seven emails.
Well, like I say, I've worked in Washington, and I've had to go into the same places, the halls of Congress, where you have for meetings and things of that nature. And when I was at Andrews and also at the Pentagon, but I was just wondering what strategies were taken and how, you know, what methods of approach. And the other question is, has any effort ever been made to film a congressman or your activities in his office?
We try to document some of our work outside the halls of Congress, but they get really, really nervous, and they don't like being filmed.
Capitol Police, you know.
It's not so much the Capitol Police as it is the individual offices, because they don't want to be. In fact, they become much more reticent if you've got cameras rolling. And so, you know, I never go through any of those doors saying, "Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. I do a radio show." I'm Bob Kincaid, who happens to live with this stuff. But to answer another one of your questions, Jim. There is no particular strategy. There's no one-size-fits-all strategy. What you do is you research the individual that you're trying to visit, and you find out what that person's interests are, and then you try. And it's not cynical. It's an attempt to, you know, once you see what their interests are, you try to find some relevance relating to what the AIC Act does.
Well, the reason I ask that question is because I know how particularly intransigent a number of these people can be, and they can be extremely hard to deal with, and their staffers can be extreme. They're basically have a, for lack of a better term, a buffer system, basically. And if you can ever get into the congressman's office to talk to him, you're doing pretty good, unless you have what I call predetermined access.
Do you have anybody from down here in Florida on it yet? You have Schultz or Grayson?
I've been in Grayson's office about four times.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? And hopefully he'll get on. God knows why he wouldn't. The two co-chairs of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which you might be surprised to know, is the single largest caucus in the entire House. The two co-chairs are Raul Grijalva and Keith Ellison. And they're both co-sponsors of the bill. So, you know, why Congressman Grayson wouldn't just, you know, giddy up and get on it, I don't know. But the one thing that always benefits the most is letters and emails and phone calls saying, you know, from his constituents saying, get on the bill.
Well, he's just a little bit north of my district. My district's actually Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Has she signed on it?
Nope.
Hmm. Send me some kind of information on what exactly it is and what it says and how it's written in my email, and I can start putting a bug in her ear because I live
in the district. Well, if you wouldn't mind, it would be a lot simpler, Jason. We've got a website for the thing.
I'll post it in the chat.
Yeah, I'll post that in the chat right now. It's AIC Act.org.
That's fine.
And on the main page there, you'll see a flyer about the AIC Act, and it's a printable PDF, two-sided, full color. And basically, it tells everything you really need to know about it. But the science that supports the AIC Act, the bill itself, is all there.
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff I need if I want to try to pester them about it. her, pester her about it. The other thing is, Bob, I was kind of wondering, I mean, you know, back when Ashley Judd was thinking about making a run for Senate, excuse me, it came out that one of her big issues was mountaintop removal.
Oh, yeah.
I was wondering, have you reached out towards her in any way, shape, or form for some help with this?
We have tried. We have not had a response.
That's too bad.
Ashley Judd is a good woman, and she is a marvelous actress, too.
And a brilliant human being, too.
Yes, she is. I mean, when I saw her play Linda Porter in DeLovely, the wife of Cole Porter, I have never seen any woman who played the part of Linda Porter more than any better than she did. Such sophistication and poise and just...
She's exhibited grace and dignity, and that's what made it all the more disgusting when it came out that Mitch McConnell was having, for lack of a better term, rat-fuck meetings. You know, that's a political term. That comes out of the Nixon administration. That's not me just deciding to use a dirty word. That's a real political term. Having those meetings, figuring out how best to try to utterly destroy her. I mean, they didn't want to just, you know, win a political race. Mitch McConnell's team wanted to destroy her because she wrote a very candid autobiography at one point and talked about suffering from depression and perhaps even suicidal ideations. And, you know, they were working on figuring out how to get her to kill herself.
Yeah, they were. And I was
very even using the campaign. Yes.
But, you know, that's typical. That's typical strategies they'll do if they find that you're going to oppose them. They will use anything they possibly can to undermine your position.
Jim, consider how tasteless and misogynistic and sick these mountaintop removal types are. They had a fundraiser in Kentucky or a rally or something where they printed out or had produced a life-size naked standalone cardboard cutout of Ms. Judd. And, you know, that's just how sleazy they are. They said she doesn't want any topless mountains and something topless Ashley Judd. Hey, by the way, note coming in from Diane in Kansas, Stan. She says, I'm listening to the Friday on the Front Porch chat on TuneIn Radio, and I'm really enjoying it, except that I'm with Kate. I vote no more snake talk.
Damn, well, every time I want to bring up snakes, somebody throw a box.
Well, that's fine. I mean, you know, the most dangerous snake in the world is not necessarily the one that crawls on the grass, and I'll leave that to your own imagination.
Yeah, I did. You're not going to... Yeah, thank you. And
we'll leave that alone. But, I mean, you know, going back to Ashley Judd, I mean, it was just terrible. I mean, you know, people have all kinds of problems and this, that, and the other, and for someone to... I mean, once you've got your, if you're in a contest and you're trying to do something and you're trying to best the person, I mean, the best thing you can do is do the best you can. And once you've got the other guy on the mat, you don't put your foot on him. I mean, it's just sportsmanlike conduct.
Well, you're absolutely right, but you have to understand that when we talk about Republicans, the only thing that matters is victory. They don't care who they hurt, who they kill, who they destroy, as long because their desire for power is overarching, and it's frankly something that we on our side have a hard time understanding.
Exactly. I mean, it's just like they don't care what they do end up doing, what they're doing to the earth now, or what they're doing. It's like they seem to think somehow magically, mystically, there's going to appear another planet to live on once they've totally screwed this one up.
Well, think about Charles Colson way back in the Nixon administration, who said that he would kill his own grandmother for Richard Nixon. And G. Gordon Liddy holding his hand over a burning flame to prove his devotion to Nixon. And it hasn't gotten better, it's gotten worse. By the way, Jim, note in from Kate. She says, thanks for the invite. Night and day, I've got you under my skin. Too darn hot. She says, humming here.
Bless her heart.
And thanks very kindly to Brian for stepping in and helping out this evening, taking a bite out of the fundraising goal for the evening. We really appreciate that. But
I haven't sent it yet, but I'm be sending you one of those 666 contributions.
Okie doke, that works. And to go back, you know, just to go back for a minute and answer or elaborate on the question, Jason, I think it was you who asked about initially about Ashley Judd. One of the problems that we face in trying to advance the AIC Act is, and I'm not being mean or anything here, but this is an absolutely brand new approach to this problem, and it's an effective approach. But organizations, and it doesn't really matter what kind of organizations they are, can get in a rut, and if they've been doing something one way for a generation, it's awfully hard to get them to think about doing it a different way. And so when you tell people, look, we're going to work from the health data and the human and the human impact, the human cost of mountaintop removal, and people are accustomed to, you know, having spent 20 years talking about the birds, bugs, beetles, and butterflies. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. But unfortunately, the interests of Congress and people to whom you will be dealing with as you proceed in your efforts, number one, they're extremely proprietary. And number two, your staffers and people like that, and I've talked with people about this thing in D.C., and I still have a few teeth in my head, so to speak, and know a few people up there. And, you know, they look at it from two points of view. And this is what I've been told, okay?
Yeah.
Number one, there is the economic and the economic impact versus the environmental impact. And that has a lot to do with, I think, the success of your mission as you proceed to deal with these people.
Well, you know, Jim, you and I share a common congressman. And I remain astonished by him because I don't feel overt hostility. I'm more just sad and hurt because at this point in time, our congressional district is the single sickest congressional district in the United States. Second is the congressional district of Hal Rogers in Kentucky, and we tend to go back and forth neck and neck year by year, and to just say mountaintop removal now, yesterday, mountaintop removal today, mountaintop removal forever. In the face of all of that illness, much of which science tends to indicate is brought on in mountaintop removal communities by mountaintop removal, is just cynical and cruel. But the other thing I would point out, Jim, is that when those folks who have talked to you said the economic impact, that means they haven't read the bill. Because one of the central tenets of the AIC Act is that nobody loses their job. Permits that are underway and working continue to work.
But the trouble is, you've got other people who are trying, lobbyists and things like that, who are trying to say that's not true and it will create economic impact. That I'm just repeating to you.
I know, but that really, that really does tell you that they're working in ideology and not actually paying attention to the content of the bill.
Well, Bob, I will say this to you, and I think you know this as well as I do. Congress is not known for its compassion.
No, it's not.
And Washington is a place where, like Harry Truman once said, if you want a friend up here, you better get a dog.
Yep. But by the same token, I don't want to sort of damn with a broad brush. There are members of Congress who do care deeply, who have profound qualities of compassion, and those are the people whose names you see on this bill.
How many do you have already?
41.
41. Well,
let me ask you something. In my best opinion, as far as coal goes, is leave it all in the ground. But that being said, is there any type of thought to maybe... You know, they've blown the tops off of all these mountains. There's nice flat ground up there now, and you'd think they got nice little roads running trucks in and out. Maybe you could stick a factory or two up there making solar panels or something.
Well, there's only one problem with that, Jason. You can't.
Yeah.
The coal industry likes to talk about how mountaintop removal is good for West Virginia because we need more flat land because we're a mountain state. But the fact of the matter is, less than, I mean, there are federal laws and federal regulations that mandate what happens to this, what happens to these sites after they've been destroyed. And it's called reclamation. But the fact of the matter is, law be damned, less than 3% of the mountaintop removal sites have been reclaimed within the meaning of the law. Less than 3%.
Oh, that's disgusting. It's disgusting to blow the top of a mountain off anyway.
And when we talk about the top, you know, we're talking about 800 to 1,200 feet.
Bob, how long has this been going on?
The first mountaintop removal operation began on the Fayette-Kanawha border in West Virginia in 1972. In 1977, the passage of the Surface Mine Control and Reclamation Act, instead of controlling and mitigating, flung the doors open and gave formal imprimatur of approval to the practice. And then in the late 90s, they started on it, and when George Bush came into office, they just geared down and burnt rubber.
He just began to accelerate?
Yeah, ridiculous.
What year was that?
George Bush comes into office in 2001.
Well, I mean, it was after 2001, I think, wasn't it? Wasn't it a couple years after that?
Oh, no. No, I mean, it was almost immediate because within weeks of Bush's inauguration, he made some statement. In fact, I think you can see a clip of it in the movie The Last Mountain where he says that his was a coal-fired election campaign. He appointed crooks and bagmen to the regulatory agencies that oversaw it. They changed the stream buffer zone rule to allow the dumping of mountaintop removal detritus into streams, burying them and covering them up, and every living thing in the valley as well. And just went hog freaking wild.
Can I just bring up something about his election in 2000? I ended up voting for Nader, and I was living in Nevada at the time. But I just figured there was
I hate to tell you, friend, you voted for Bush if you voted for Nader.
Well,
Nevada, but anyway, because Nevada went Bush anyway.
Yeah, it was a safe vote.
Like Borio did better. But, anyway, the thing is, when Bush got elected, when he was running, I thought, don't people see, okay, you had Bush won in 1988, 1992, all of a sudden his son's running, and then it's like, what are we starting? A monarchy, and it's happening with the Clintons. You got Bill, and now Hillary. Is Chelsea running soon? Are the Bush daughters running soon?
No, I'd be worrying about Poppy Bush. That's Jeb's son.
Yeah. And then you go back to the Bush crime family. What were they doing in... they were backing the Nazis in the early... Before, you know, World War II got... I mean,
that's why Daddy Prescott got busted for the... under the Trading with the Enemy Act.
Well, don't worry about the Bushes also. You can deal with Henry Ford because he made a lot of vehicles for Hitler.
Yeah, but in the case of the Bushes in particular, Jim, we're talking about the fact that Prescott Bush, working for a banking house called Brown Brothers Harriman, leveraged Union Banking and Trust to become the pass-through financial agent for a guy named Fritz Thyssen.
I'm familiar with the German industrialist. Yes, I am. But Henry Ford also, you can put him in the same category.
Oh, sure. IBM. IBM, too.
Yeah, there were a lot
of... Oh, yeah, definitely IBM. They created the, what was it, the punch cars they used to track the...
Exactly.
The trains cars. Full of...
The Gestapo under Heydrich helped incorporate that system. Because before Heydrich was assassinated in May of 1942, they had gone to some type of automated system to keep a track of all of the people that they wanted to eliminate. And that's how they were able at the Wannsee Conference in January of 1942 to actually give you in a spreadsheet. And if you look at Wannsee Conference, you'll see it all right there.
or if you see the film on HBO called Conspiracy.
Yeah, and one of my favorite sort of speculative fiction movies is that Rutger Hauer film that was done for HBO called Fatherland.
Right.
And that's brilliant.
But that was just fantasy. But I mean, talk about reality. When you look at the Wannsee conference, when they had the papers thrown around the desk or the table where they all had a magnificent dinner at this beautiful estate in Wannsee, which is now a Holocaust memorial, you will see in the spreadsheet my country, all of the people, and it's basically nothing more than a forerunner of the modern day spreadsheet of the numbers of people, and the Germans were very methodical, and they were able to use a lot of devices and things of that nature to calculate and to organize the rolling stock and the actual capturing of individuals for whom those rolling stocks were intended. And I will never forget my experience when I was at the Holocaust Museum in Washington when it first opened. I was open there the first day of sitting in one of those cattle cars and actually picking up one of the stones from Mannhausen that those people had to carry up a hill.
Well,
and you know, when I went to that Holocaust Museum, and it took the whole day, and it was a total experience to see exactly the inhumanity of man to man, and how could this have happened, and why would it have happened amongst such an ancient and honorable people as the German people, whom I greatly respect, and for all of the contributions they've made to music and art, literature, science in particular. But yet, you know, it did happen.
Indeed. And just to back up for a second, just got a tweet in from Sandra, and she said, "Don't worry, Chelsea will be running in 20 years." And there's probably truth in that. And I want us to understand, you know, because Jim, was it you or raised the issue of the Bushes and then the Clintons?
Yeah, that was me.
Yeah. Well, the fact of the matter is, we should not be surprised by this, because this is how empires evolve. The Roman one in particular being instructive. You know, Julius Caesar, who never got to be emperor, was murdered, and he had only one daughter, and she died in childbirth, giving birth to the son of Gnaeus Pompeius, otherwise known as Pompey the Great. So Roman culture, tradition, law allowed adoptions, and it wasn't like the way we do adoption. You could, for instance, a person could be adopted as a full-grown adult into a family. And so by his will, Caesar sets out the adoption of his grandnephew Octavian, who then battles against Mark Antony and before that the conspirators, Brutus and Cassius and the rest of them, who killed Caesar, and eventually with the help of Marcus Agrippa consolidates power. Well, then you begin to get the Julio-Claudian dynasty, okay, that leads from Octavian, who would later be known as Augustus, through Tiberius, the disaster of Caligula, then Claudius, then Nero, and once Nero kicks his pregnant wife to death, that ends the Julio-Claudian dynasty. And what happens is, even though it remains an empire, just one second, even though it remains an empire, you begin to see a sort of, not really meritocracy, but a choice from plutocratic families, throughout the remainder of the empire. And I don't think we should be at all surprised to see that the same thing is beginning to develop in the United States.
You saying that, let me just say this real quick. I saw a little bit on the so-called liberal channel, MSNBC, a little blurb, but it was about the Clinton, it was about the Bush girls. And I didn't really, hear it, but they're coming like it's royalty.
Bobby, before, I wanted to ask a question. Michael Parenti
wanted me to read a book that he wrote called The Assassination of Julius Caesar. And I have the book. I haven't started it. I assume that he is supportive of Julius Caesar. And my perception of how you've talked about Julius Caesar is that he was not a very pleasant or a very good example of a representative or of a ruler. So I wanted to about that.
That book, Larry, is magnificent, and I absolutely love it. I don't mean to convey a disapproval of Caesar. Caesar was a man of his times, and as compared to a Quintus Metellus, or for God's sakes, Cato, we call him Cato, and he was held up as a hero when all that Cato was a stalking horse for the maintenance of the status quo, which was a brutal consolidation of wealth among the people who called themselves the boni, the best men, and at the time of Julius Caesar, it was the squaring off between the populares, the people, the those who were arguing for the people, and the boni. And Julius Caesar was very clearly a member of the populares. So no, I don't have a dim opinion of Caesar. He was among the best of the people.
Kind of like the opposite of Reagan and Bush administrations.
Well, the other question that I wanted is that you've given a lot of good information today about how to go about doing lobbying in congressional people's offices. I would like to be able to have that, to be able to listen to again. Will this show be on the White Rose Society?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Thank you very much.
It'll go up as a podcast just shortly after the close of the program. Oh, and thanks by the way, going out to Jack in Shreveport. He and Brian have both helped out this evening. So we've taken the fundraising goal from 195 down to 165, and that's a big help. But yeah, but Larry, if you've already got you've actually engaged in dialogue with Michael Parenti?
Well, I know the man because he lives in Berkeley. We're not buddy-buddy, but I've been to a number of his speeches. He brought me over a present over in my apartment. Didn't stay terribly long. I was pretty depressed. But he did bring me over a copy of his book, and I have seen him at a number of events in Berkeley, California. Yes, he lives here.
How neat. And yes, that is a magnificent book, because not only is it brilliant by virtue of how it attempts to re-examine the evidence concerning how and why Gaius Julius Caesar was assassinated, it's also brilliant because of the things that he writes about how history gets produced. And that is as important within that book as the actual case that he makes regarding his theories about the assassination of Caesar.
I have to tell you, Bob, and you're in the middle of a conversation, but I have to tell you, one of my, I would like to get a really good book on historiography or the methods of history.
If Dr. John is listening, I'll bet he is probably already writing. Or when he does hear this, because that is right in Dr. John's wheelhouse, and he'll probably be able to suggest a text.
Well, historiography basically is a very complex discipline, and you have so many books that are written about so many historiographical situations. I mean, you know, there's just one course alone in graduate school with historiography about, for example, British nation and the empire. So, I mean, you know, you're going to have to subdivide that into a whole lot of different categories as far as historiographical references and who wrote who and who said what and what their opinions were and that type of thing.
And that's kind of the point that I was making, Jim, with regard to Michael Parenti's book. And if you've never read it, Jim, you would enjoy it immensely too, I imagine. It's a very, very quick, easy read. But it's information rich, and and that's, you know, that's what he's talking about, because he examines the sources for what we know about the assassination of Gaius Julius Caesar, and then he talks about why the sources say what they do. And for instance, it becomes really important beyond a mere scholarly appreciation or examination when you realize the esteem, for instance, that the founders and, of this country and the framers of the Constitution held not for Caesar, but for Cato, who swore up and down he was standing for liberty, but it turned out he was just standing for the status quo and the maintenance of concentrated wealth in the hands of a very few. And that's how you wind up with that filthy, disgusting, rotten, infernal bunch in D.C. that operate under the name of the Cato Institute. We remember who helped found the Cato Institute, right?
Right.
The Koch brothers.
It's weird the way they almost put it out there for you to see, but people, because they don't know history and they're just too goddamn stupid, don't.
Look, Jim, most people think that Cato is a store in the mall that sells women's wear.
Well, that's true.
I was thinking they thought it was Green Hornet's sidekick.
Well, him too.
Yeah, exactly that.
Hey, guys, we got to get out of here, but this has been a lot of fun. And, Duncan, if you're up for it or anybody else wants to help out along the way, if this turned into what we do on Fridays, I think it would just be awesome. And invite more people into the conversation and via phone or the Skype group. I don't know anywhere else that this is happening.
Well, I've enjoyed this tremendously, gentlemen, and thank you very much for your inputs and listening to me, what I've had to say, even though you may not agree with it or whatever, but I certainly enjoyed talking with you.
Well, thank you, Jim. You have yourself a good night.
I enjoyed it, and thank you very much, and I enjoyed everybody's comments and everything. It's very interesting and enlightening.
Well, thank you, Jim, and stay cool down there in St. Tammany.
Bob.
All right, bye now.
Bob.
Yeah, Duncan.
Yeah, just like you said before, if anybody wants to join this group, I mean, we go to Voice every Friday night after Malloy. There's no Malloy tonight, so we may start earlier. It's a rerun.
Yeah.
So anyway, just send your contact information to Bob, and he'll shoot it to me.
Yeah, Bob at BobKincaid@gmail.com.
And I'll send you an invite to join the group.
Yeah.
I'll be glad to do this any Friday you guys want to, Bob, I can.
I understand. You know, it's subject to everybody's schedules. But, you know, let's just go forward thinking that this is what we're going to do, because like I said, and I'm not holding myself up as better or worse or anything like that, this is just something that isn't happening anywhere else. And this really is the kind of conversation dialogue that badly needs to be happening. But it can happen here because we don't suffer under the constraints of having to tell people to buy gold now or the bowling balls you can pick up with a vacuum cleaner and drop on a Swedish mattress.
I mean, I definitely enjoyed this, and I'm definitely up for this every Friday.
All right.
So basically what we do every Friday night after midnight anyway.
We have a really wonderful group, and we really like to have as many people. I can't speak for Dunk or speak for Lottie or the people that moderate the group, but what I can say is that the more people that come in, the more enlightening the discussion is, and it's really great. So all of you that would like to come in, try to come in.
Indeed, and by the way,
we max out at 22, Larry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
That's enough anyway, too. By the way.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to get a word in.
Too many, and it's going to be.
And so hey, we are fast running out of time, but Larry, I wanted to let you know I just got a tweet from Sandra, and she said the information literate historian Jenny L. Presnell. I may be mispronouncing that, but Jenny L. Presnell. And she says it's a general text all about doing history. And so if Sandra recommends it, you can go to the bank with it.
Presnell, and thank you, Sandra. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Duncan. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, Sergi. And thank you, Grant, even though you've been kind of quiet. That happens sometimes. I understand. You guys have a wonderful weekend. Maybe I'll see you in the Skype chat later this evening. And we'll try this again next week. I think it's awfully cool.
All right, thanks, Bob. Skunk.
All right,
thanks,
Bob. Thanks, y'all.
Thanks, Skunk, for doing this.
And that's Friday on the Front Porch, the way it was meant to be. I'm Bob Kincaid. It's time to get out of here. Rick Smith is on his way. Have a wonderful weekend.